You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I think John Fugelsang had the best tweet about the entire Oscars. This is hysterical. He says, Rush Limbaugh just saw Michelle Obama give best picture to a film where the heroes are Canada, Hollywood, and Jimmy Carter. Predictably, right-wing heads exploded all over the nation, and Michelle Obama's getting a lot of flack for it. Gee, what a surprise. But anyhow. So, and the sequester, 4 days out, we're going to be talking about that. You know, Congress did this. Why can't they just undo it? But we will get to that. Dr. Stephanie Kelton is going to be here in our second hour, economist and chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, the editor-in-chief of the New Economic Perspectives blog about modern monetary theory. And in our third hour, Joshua Holland, the 15 biggest lies about the economy. And it appears that somebody has found Ronald Reagan's welfare queen after only 30 years. Maybe. But you'll hear, as Paul Harvey would say, the late Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story in our third hour. Right now, Kerry Lucas is with us, the managing director of the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. Hey, Kerry, nice to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. You wrote an op-ed in which you were basically trashing preschool programs that the president has come out and spoken in favor of, rather glowingly of.
Let's be clear, Tom. I was trashing the federal government providing new subsidies for preschool programs. I think it's fabulous if parents want to choose that. But there's a problem when the government is getting involved and trying to subsidize this choice.
In your opinion?
Sure.
Yeah. My opinion. Okay. All right. So I'm curious, what is that problem? Why should we, the people, through our federal tax dollars, not make investments in our young people that actually return more than, for every dollar invested, return as much as $17 to $25 back?
Well, first of all, Tom, that presumption that this is such a huge economic win is just not borne out by the facts. And I think it's important for people to remember when the president, there's something, when we talk about preschool and the government subsidizing preschool, there was an interesting word the president didn't use during that conversation, and that was Head Start. Because, of course, if you're going to talk about this as if obviously the people who were worried about when it comes to not being able to choose preschool if they want, it's people who have low income. But of course, there is a federal program to help those who can't afford preschool to make that choice, and that's Head Start. But sadly, the congressionally mandated government studies through the Department of Education have shown that Head Start doesn't return benefits. There's no lasting impact on school outcomes associated with Head Start. So this whole idea
of
20 cents on the dollar is...
I dispute your numbers.
Okay.
In fact, Science Magazine, which is the official publication of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS, volume 333, 19 August 2011, they're reporting on a 40-year longitudinal study. This was done, they took a group of low-income African-American children and a control group in the early 1960s and literally looked at them up until 2011. And half of these kids, and they were able to thereby take out issues of income, of race, of neighborhood, of single or non-single parent, fluency or competence or literacy of the parents. They were able to equalize or normalize for all of those variables. So the only variable was whether or not these children had access to a preschool program.
This was
called the Perry Preschool Program, yes.
It was
a government-sponsored preschool program. It was not Head Start.
How many people were in that program, Tom?
123.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's an important number for your listeners to hear, because it's 123 people. You're going to be talking about this program as trumping the congressionally mandated study or being more important than the study of the Head Start program, which involves thousands and thousands of kids, and which was done specifically.
There are numerous studies of Head Start which demonstrate that Head Start produces.
You brought up this Perry preschool program, Tom, because that's your.
You haven't even let me finish my sentence.
Okay. You guys always turn to this ridiculous study of 123 kids with it, which had a.
We
a
always do,
top to bottom, tens of thousands of dollars spent on them. But okay, go ahead with the Perry preschool program. I don't know how that applies to what the president's proposing, but that's fine.
Well, actually, we could instead do the Chicago preschool program or the Abacadarian preschool program.
That's the biggest. That's the model that we'd be using, right, Tom? I mean,
no, to the best of my knowledge, it's not.
Okay.
You know, Head Start has gone through a lot of incarnations over the years. It's a very different program than it was back in the 60s when I was actually a Head Start volunteer teacher. Head Start has had so many holes drilled in it over the years by Republicans. But in any case, what they found was that if these kids, again, taking all these factors out, arrested by the age of 40, non-preschool kids, 55%. Preschool kids, 36%. Earned over $20,000 at the age of 40. 60% of the kids.
That's interesting, and I think that there is a case to be made.
So you don't want to hear the statistics?
Oh, I mean, I've heard them all. Fine. If you want to tell, this just has nothing to do with what the president is proposing.
Well, actually, it has everything to do with what the president is proposing.
No, it doesn't, Tom, because you're talking about a program that went to the very poorest of kids with the worst life circumstances. And yes, the interventions for them, that's what Head Start is justified on. But that's what the president is proposing, is creating this for another middle class entitlement, one that of course we can't afford, and which is modeled on our K-12 education system.
So, which doesn't work so terribly that no K-12 education system in the world works. I mean, come on, Carrie, you're defying logic here.
Okay, but why? So are you? Are we trying to replace Head Start? Is this a? Are you and the president proposing?
I am not talking about Head Start.
If Perry preschool is the model, then this is clearly something that's just targeted to low income kids, which is just duplicative of Head Start, right? Or are we talking about middle class kids? Because then Perry preschool has nothing to do with it.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis. I think
that there's a lot of people out there who wonder at what point is it that this you know, we can promise all sorts of things.
Well, no, hang on just a second. If middle class kids are benefiting from public education K-12, why would they not benefit from a couple of years pre-K?
Are we? I mean, we've seen, this is the thing, is that we don't know that preschool is necessarily good for kids when we're talking about middle class kids. If you look at, you know, Head Start, they've tried and tried and they can't find any long-term lasting effects from Head Start. That's a big surprise because there have been these studies.
I don't believe that's true, Carrie.
Okay, well, Tom, look at this.
I don't believe the assertion you're making.
Okay, this is, okay, I can send you the link.
Please do, because you certainly didn't say it in your article, you know, that you sent us.
Sure I do. Talking about Head Start came out, and this is the kind of thing, it's a shame, because this is something the left purposely buried. There was a congressionally mandated study of Head Start to see what the long-term effects of Head Start have been. And it came out about 6 months ago, and it showed that, once again, this is the second time that they showed this, that they can't find any benefits. There's immediate benefits, but then by the time kids are in about third grade, the benefits have disappeared. And so this was a surprise, because there have been these promising results.
Okay, Carrie, thanks for setting this up, and thanks for the information. I frankly don't know, and I'm going to have to look into this, and I promise all of our listeners and viewers, I will report back to you tomorrow on the details of this. Carrie, thank you for sensitizing me to this.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, Carrie Lucas of the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. If you know about Head Start, get over there and let them know. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. I am. Oh, there is a hot link here in Carrie's article that says Head Start. But I haven't It's a dead link, Shane says. You're not kidding. Okay. All right. Lynn in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, Lynn, what is it that I don't know about Head Start? What's going on here?
Well,
it seems to be common knowledge on the conservative sphere, and I always thought Head Start was a great program that worked really well and produced returns.
Well, there's been lots of debate about that, but I think that this study, whoever even heard about it, you know, nobody really talks about these things because it primarily affects poor people. It does not affect the middle class, first of all, and that's what she was talking about. This is strictly for poor children. Period.
What's the this that you're talking about?
Head Start.
Okay.
Is strictly for poor children. It has income limits, first of all. And she was talking, she kept saying middle class families.
Right.
Just two different, you know, apples and oranges. This study showed that not only did Head Start.
Which study?
The Head Start study from Congress.
The one that Carrie's referencing. Okay.
Right.
But I can't find a link to
it. That proves to her that the whole world should not go to preschool.
Right.
This study proved that exactly opposite of what she's saying, that they do benefit from preschool education. The premise was, does it help them when they get to school? Period. That's all it talked about.
So the reason why this study did not demonstrate that 20 years later, there's not a lasting benefit for these kids is that the study isn't a 20-year-long study?
It only went until 2006, and it went to six-year-olds, till they were 6 years old. End. Done.
So we have no idea.
No.
So to say that there's no provable outcome is nonsense because we haven't looked for the...
Not in this study.
Yeah.
Not in the study she's talking about.
Well, assuming that this is the study she's talking about, the link in her article is dead. I'm going to have to track this down. She said she'd send me the link. I'll read it.
All I did was I Googled Head Start study U.S. Congress, and this came up. It was called for in 1998, which she said, and was started in 2002.
Right.
What took 2006, and then they spent the next 5 years going through the data. And this is what they came up with.
And what did they come up with?
That it does improve a child's learning in the early years of school, in kindergarten and first grade.
Right.
It does improve.
And they couldn't look beyond that because it was only a six-year study.
Right. No, it was only 4 years, actually.
Four-year study.
2002 till 2006.
Okay. Well, that being the case, then, thank you very much for clearing that up. Assuming that that's the case, Lynn, thank you very much for that. I appreciate that. And,
no problem.
And, in fact, if you would let me put you on hold here, we're going to give away a copy of the Tom Hartman Reader here today, and courtesy of Stamps.com. And, Lynn, you're going to get it, an autographed copy. Shane, she's on line 3 if you want to pass that along. So the... Now, looking, apparently Carrie's study, the one that she's referencing, the congressional study, did not look at long-term outcomes of preschool. But when you look at a 40-year longitudinal study, a study that was started in the 1960s and just finished in 2011, what we found was there's three different studies that were done. One was the Perry Pre-K study, one was the Abacadarian study, one was the Chicago study. The cost of the Perry, the cost-benefit ratio, the Perry Pre-K study, what they found was that for every dollar invested in these children, now they looked at these kids for 40 years. For every dollar invested, $17 in benefits to the taxpayers in tax income came back. In the Abacadarian study, for every dollar invested, $3.78 came back. In the Chicago study, for every dollar invested, $7.14 came back. Kids who had, now this is economic effects at the age of 27. And again, this is a study that looked at children who were 2, 3, 4 years old, who were enrolled in preschool programs. And these were all low-income African-American kids. Of the kids who were not part of the program, at the age of 27, 7% of them were making more than $2,000 a month, $24,000 a year. Of the kids who were in the preschool programs, 29% of them. So that's more than four times as many. That's a 400% increase plus in just earning over $2,000 a month. In owning their own home, the kids who did not go through the preschool program, 13% of them at the age of 27, 13% of them owned their own home. 36% of those kids who did go through the program owned their own home. So three times as many. So you're three times more likely to own your own home if you went through a preschool program at the age of 27, if you went through a preschool program at the age of 3. At the age of 27, never having been on welfare as an adult. Again, these are children who, when they were 3 years old, were the poorest African-American kids in these communities. 41% of the entire population had never been on, 20% of the entire population had never been on welfare. So 80% had been on welfare at one point or another. 41% had never been on welfare. Now, at the age of 40, it's even more interesting. At the age of 40, the kids who had been through a preschool school program, 60% of them earned over $20,000 a year, whereas only 40% of the kids who had never been through a preschool program by the time they were at the age of 40, earned more than $20,000 a year. 62% of the kids who did not go through preschool were employed at the age of 40. 76% of those who did go through preschool were employed. Half of the people at the age of 40 who had not gone through preschool had a savings account. 76% of the ones who went through preschool had a savings account. And, you know, on and on it goes. I mean, every time I tried to mention these statistics, Carrie started talking, and you know, I can see why now. The response is just extraordinary. The return, when you look at these over a 20, 30, 40-year period, very good results.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So that, plus the question, this question that I have, if Congress put the sequester into place, why can't they just take the sequester? Here's one of the most interesting findings from this Perry High School preschool program. By the way, during the break, I did my own Googling. I went to the National Head Start Association. They've got all kinds of research there. They're pointing to studies, congressional studies and other studies, that all demonstrate that there's a good consequence to Head Start. A. B. The president never talked about Head Start. We were talking about preschool. And see, I can't, you know, so we'll see. If Carrie, I want to give her the benefit of the doubt and assume that she was not misrepresenting or lying to me, and that she will send me an actual congressional study that shows that Head Start has no value, basically. If that's the case, I'll be quite surprised, because I was able to find about a dozen studies very quickly on the web showing that Head Start actually produces positive, beneficial results. And go back to this this 40-year-long study of this group of kids who were had preschool versus not had preschool. Here's one of the most startling statistics. At the age of 40, the kids who had preschool had 67% of them had an IQ 5 points above 28% of them. Well, actually, it's IQ 90 plus at 5. Okay, that'd be at the age of 5. 67% among the kids who went through the preschool program, 28% among the kids who didn't. Arrested by five plus times by the age of 40. Again, poor African-American kids, worst possible outcomes. At the age of 40, over half who had not gone through preschool, 55% had been arrested. Only 36% who had gone through preschool had been arrested. So earning $20,000, I shared those statistics. Graduated high school. 60% who did not go through the program, 77% who did go through the preschool program. Pretty straightforward stuff. Heidi in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Heidi, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to Carrie, and I'm really angry, so I've jotted things down, so I hope I can be clear.
Sure.
But I have a master's degree in elementary education, and when I have a 12-year-old daughter, And when she was young, we were going through a really, really hard time. I'm a single mother, and I was really suffering from depression. So my daughter qualified for Head Start. And I think, well, first of all, Head Start was an enormous help to us. Maybe she would have done well in school educationally, but she really needed that emotional support. And, you know, we still have friendships with the kids that she went through Head Start with. And we have continued as mothers to help each other and to support each other.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter, she ended up being diagnosed with a speech and language deficit. She was able to get the help she needed in Head Start. A speech therapist came in there and helped her. It really helped her in an emotional context.
Yeah. So your personal experience has been that Head Start was a positive thing. And
yes, but also as a teacher. And, you know, I think part of this is a racism, and part of it is an attack on women. Because I will tell you, I'm white. We were living in a small city at the time. Most everybody in all the kids in my daughter's Head Start class were white kids. You know, we've gone back to the small town. I've seen them. They're doing well. And I also feel that this is partly an attack on women and unions, because Head Start teachers are by and large women. They have a degree and they're making a living wage. And the thing is, if
you can't have that.
Well, if you can do away with, you know, qualified Head Start people and put kids into daycare, you can manage to pay them, minimum wage, and, you know, places like Bright Horizons, you know, owned by Romney's company, can make a whole lot of money off the backs of women paying them minimum wage. And the other thing that I wanted to say, you know, about my experience, it definitely needs to be a middle class entitlement, because I'm working now and things are much, much better in our lives. But as a teacher, and I talk to other teachers, they cannot afford, they don't make enough money to put their children into preschool.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk to so many women, you know, and again, I feel this is an attack on women. Women generally, you know, in the low professions, you know, like teachers, social workers, they can't make enough to put their own children into childcare.
Yeah.
Or into preschool.
It's a really sad commentary on.
Well, also, you know, I called Dr. Mike a few weeks ago. He was subbing for you.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years ago, I was pregnant with twins, and I had to do a selective reduction. I basically had to abort one twin because I could not afford preschool or childcare for them, and I needed to work to support my other child.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured out, even as a teacher, if I went down to a paraeducator position, I would still be making just a few dollars too much a month, right, to be able to put twins in childcare.
Right. That's a tough one. Heidi, I've got a whole board lit up here with people who want to get in on this. So thank you for your comments. Let me move along. TC in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, TC, what's up?
Yes, listen to your discussion regarding this Head Start. It's sort of being circumvented by the use of the word middle, or the words middle class, because obviously the study indicates lower income class. And if you go back and read the study, it's approximately 420 pages. And if you read the findings, they're identified in Chapter 9-1. It talks about all the benefits and all the differences that were, should we say, resulted from the actual study.
Mm-hmm.
So I think because the use of the word middle class is sort of being misdirected.
In other words, the study, we found the 420-page study, looking over it, you know, scanning it quickly, Shano and Danielle and I. It looks like what it's saying is that Head Start is of value to these kids, but basically the Head Start programs, because there's an income cap, in other words, basically because they're for low-income kids, conceivably Carrie's assertion was that it's meaningless for middle-class kids because they didn't actually study the middle-class kids.
That is correct.
Yeah.
So
okay.
if you if you really listen to...
So in principle, she's simply objecting to a new middle class entitlement.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's all that's going on.
Okay, I got it. I got it. Yeah. TC, thanks a lot for the call. Art in South Padre Island, Texas. Hey, Art.
How are you doing?
Good. You were involved in a study?
I wanted to bring up... Yes, in 1969, I went to Pan American University in Edinburgh, Texas. And in my kid's psych class, I made a deal with the professor if I could study this small building on campus, which had no windows. It was carpeted, had television, audio equipment, boards, chalkboards, and one-way viewing mirrors, where children from the ages of 2 to 4 years old were placed in this building with no windows. And they did not have to ask to go to the bathroom. They did not have to ask to get water. They just did it. And the person who was running the test told me that they were writing descriptive sentences by the age of 3. And I did my paper on that in 1969 at Pan American University. Mm-hmm. And so whoever Kerry is doesn't know what she's talking about, because I witnessed it myself and was amazed to see how advanced the children were at such a young age.
Right, even in less than ideal circumstances. So your bottom line is that you've seen a preschool program work. All right, thanks for calling and sharing that with us. Mary Jo in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Mary Jo.
Hi, Tom. I love your show, and I love Bernie Sanders. I wish he would run for president. Anyways, my personal 23-year study of preschool is I didn't send them to Head Start because I'm middle class. I make up too much money. Right. I did send both my daughters to 3- and 4-year-old preschool. They are now 23 and 21. They are both in the College of Nursing. One is on the dean's list, and one is on the honor roll. Right. So I truly believe, especially for poor children, that early education is very important to get them started in the concept of school and to get them on the path to middle class. And I believe the Republicans do not want that to happen.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. Mary Jo, thank you for the call. Heather in Las Vegas. Hey, Heather, we have a minute to the break.
Okay, I just wanted to, I guess I am one of the people that everyone's kind of referring to. I am a single mom that is considered middle class, so I never was able to, or my kids to qualify for Head Start, so I pay out of pocket for my kids to go to preschool because of the hours that I work. And for the case of my youngest, it cost me just for him $16,000 a year for daycare/preschool. And I get no assistance because I make too much money. And now I'm in a situation where the state of Nevada does not recognize the test because of when his birthday falls. His birthday is actually in October, and their deadline to cut off for school to start regular school
so,
is
So, Heather, what's your point? I'm missing something.
That they need to raise the limits. I would have a full-day kindergarten, have preschool for everybody.
I see. So you're in favor of the president's suggestion that we have that basically the age at which all kids are available for school be lowered from 5, from kindergarten to preschool age, like 3.
100%.
Okay. Thank you, Heather. Thank you. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Well, there seems to be a pretty broad consensus developing here that there's a value to preschool. We'll continue the conversation. Welcome back. Well, increasingly it's appearing that Head Start programs are targeted toward low-income people, and they do produce a positive and measurably positive result, and that the essence, and if I'm mischaracterizing this, I promise you I will apologize on the air and correct it, but increasingly it's looking, in fact, I was tempted to say, let's get Kerry back on the line and ask her, but she lives in Austria, and it's a little more of a challenge. But yeah, although Kerry, if you're listening in, call us back. My understanding is that basically the argument that she was making is that because the study did not look at middle class kids because they're not eligible for Head Start, therefore there's no proof that Head Start would be of value to middle class kids. And because Kerry is philosophically opposed to government entitlement programs like, say, public education, we shouldn't do more. And that, to me, does not seem like an argument. It seems like a statement of philosophy. But maybe I'm missing something. We'll see. Dawn in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Dawn, what's up?
Yes, I was, and technically I'm not lower class. I'm lower middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two kids. My own.
Economically speaking.
I could not afford preschool for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I didn't know about the Head Start program. And so we did part-time preschool for 1 year with a private preschool for her.
Mm-hmm.
And then my youngest, I found out about the local county Head Start program. Mm-hmm. And although we didn't get it free because, we were lower middle class, we did get some benefit because she had a speech impediment and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I see a distinct difference between the two kids in their ability to work together on a team, which is just as important in adulthood.
Sure.
And it helped prepare them for school. It's like my youngest, who went through the 2 years of preschool, is one of the only kids I know who will say, "I hope there's not a snow day tomorrow because I want to go to school."
Hmm. Interesting. And so you're what you've seen between two kids, one with a lot of preschool, one without, is that the one with preschool had significant advantages that the one without doesn't. In other words,
right. And they both do well, very well academically, but I find my oldest has to work harder for it because she doesn't want to step in there and participate, and it's harder for her to work.
Right. Let it be noted that, individual anecdotes don't a study make, but I'm looking at the studies here, and the studies look like, Head Start for low-income kids and other programs, the Perry High School preschool program and others, the Chicago preschool program, that there are measurable, demonstrable differences, improvements. For every dollar invested, you get up to $17 back. Society gets back when we put kids, low-income kids, the ones who've been studied, through preschool programs. And the question is, will that work for middle-class kids as well? I'm getting a lot of anecdotal reports from parents saying, yes, it will. Common sense would indicate, yes, it will. I'm still looking for studies on that. I haven't seen any yet that show either way. But, Dawn, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to AM 760 there in Denver. Fred in Lacey, Washington. Hey, Fred. Head Start?
Hey, Tom. Very good to talk to you again. I believe that Head Start was started in the 60s for high school kids to get into college early. And which is now called Running Start. My mother homeschooled me, and I was reading at the age of 3. And I graduated high school at 16 and a half, and I went to college with some kids that were in that Head Start program in the 60s, all done very well. But the point I really wanted to make was that the underprivileged kids that get to go into Head Start get a meal. They get nutrition. That's very important in a developing mind.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You're not only taking education away from them, you're taking food away from them.
Right, but again, Carrie's argument was, she's not here to speak for herself, and so I may be mischaracterizing, but my understanding of her argument was that's all and well and good for lower income kids, and she's not opposing that, but for middle income kids, middle class kids, let's not create another entitlement. And that's one where I'm frankly in favor of creating another entitlement, because this is investing in our educational infrastructure, which I think is frankly our most important infrastructure. It's the reason why I think we should have free college education as well, because we're investing in the most important infrastructure we have, our young people. Fred, thank you for the call. Marie in Pipe Creek, Texas. Hey, Marie, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You worked in Head Start for 20 years, really?
I worked in a town, and in the 20 years, I was very involved in different ways with Head Start.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that I noticed and was very impressed with was that Head Start not only worked with the kids, but it also worked with the whole family as a whole. Because they understood that some of the problems that some of the kids have as far as not learning things has to do, of course, with their family environment. And that was very important to them. You know, they taught the kids how to socialize, like the other lady mentioned, mm-hmm. How to get along with other kids, to work as a team. They also, they have like parent councils where a great percentage of the council has to be made up of the parents themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so they also empowered the parents and in that way help the parents, you know, to better themselves. They brought up issues of domestic violence. They had free parenting classes for parents. The kids, you know, learned about nutrition, about good health, about exercise. If the kids needed help medically, the teachers and the Head Start staff, you know, helped or tried to refer them to places to get help. It was a very meaningful program, and I was very impressed. And the families that participated with Head Start,
they benefited as well. Marie, we're out of time, but thank you. Thank you for the call and sharing your story and your perspective. Up next, Dr. Stephanie Kelton, economist and chair of the Department of Economics at Missouri, Kansas City.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio at every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide. Welcome back to our program. Dr. Stephanie Kelton is with us, economist and chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City and editor-in-chief of the New Economic Perspectives blog, neweconomicperspectives.org. Dr. Kelton, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's great to join you.
It is great to have you with us. I've watched enough video clips of you that I feel like I know you. First of all, can you give us a snapshot, your summary of what modern monetary theory means?
Well, I guess the easiest way to say it is to say that it's the way of doing economics that brings us into the 21st century. It recognizes the simple fact that we're not on a gold standard anymore, and so much of the way that we teach economics today, and not just in the U.S., but all around the world, is based on these outmoded ideas that are no longer relevant in the modern era. And so what modern money theory does is really recognize that the system works very differently today by virtue of the fact that the monetary system changed in a really important way in 1971, and that is the year in which we broke from gold. And so we have this monetary system today that is based on a pure, we say, fiat money. And it just doesn't work the way it used to work under the old system. But we act like we're still hamstrung by the same sorts of constraints that were present under the old system that are gone. And we aren't taking advantage of a whole range of policy options that we can adopt now that weren't really available to us before.
Okay, so under the old system, when we were, before Nixon closed the gold window in 71, we were basically constrained in the number of dollars that we could produce by the amount of gold we had. Is that an accurate statement as point one?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, you had to be very careful when running your fiscal and monetary policy, because what you were pledging to do was to convert the currency into gold, which is, of course, a limited, finite resource. And so you had to be very careful about how many dollars you actually created and had in circulation, because if you had too many people all at the same time deciding, I don't want to hold the dollar, I want to convert into gold, then you could run into real problems in terms of keeping that monetary system.
So how do you respond to somebody who says in 1971, if you paid $15,000 or $20,000 for a house, that house right now would sell for $200,000 or $300,000. In fact, in 2007, probably would have sold for $400,000. Isn't that evidence that we should have stayed on the gold standard? I mean, that's basically the kind of Ron Paul response.
Right. So, well, I would say to them, you know, we had 8 depressions while we were on the gold standard, and we've had 0 since we've gone off the gold standard. So the gold standard is one of these monetary systems that works until you need it most, and then it doesn't work, which is why every country in the world abandons gold when you have an economic crisis like the one that we had in 2007. If we had been on a gold standard then, we would have been forced off the gold standard.
But
just
haven't,
like
but
so
haven't
many
we seen the value of our currency collapse?
Well, no, we sure haven't. But this is something that lots of people were ringing the alarm bells about, right? I mean, when the Fed began intervening in these unprecedented ways with quantitative easing and so forth, a lot of the gold bugs started running around and saying, this is the end of the world. The dollar is going to become worthless. It's going to collapse. We're going to end up like Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe. The dollar won't be worth the paper it's printed on and so forth. And, of course, none of that happened. I mean, these folks have been really, really wrong about things.
Although the price of gold has gone from, you know, well, in the just 15 years ago, it was selling for around $230 an ounce, and it's like $1,600 an ounce now. Is that an indication of a change in the price of that particular commodity or in the value of the dollar?
Well, it's certainly an indication of a change in the price of the commodity, because that's why the price of gold is going up. You've got a lot of people who have this belief, you know, that the currency is going to become worthless, and their fears and anxiety drive them to purchase commodities like gold. And so it drives up the price of gold. And we're seeing now, you know, these corrections in terms of gold. And as market participants begin to understand that the dollar is actually not going to collapse, well, then gold becomes a less appealing investment.
So as a fiat currency, our dollar is no longer backed by gold. It is backed by the wealth and full faith and credit of the United States government. Do I have that right?
Sure. You know, the dollar definitely has value. I mean, we all are willing to work and provide things in order to get the currency. And so it isn't, it is intrinsically worthless in the sense that the currency itself, the bills and notes and so forth, don't have intrinsic value, but they have value nonetheless. And the reason that we're all willing to work and provide resources in order to get these is essentially because the dollar is a tax credit.
So, yeah, and we can get into that, and I understand that. But just to put a nail in the coffin of this story, you know, that oh, my God, since we went off the gold standard, everything's falling apart. How do you rebut that in the face of, you know, that in 1971 a good middle class income was $12,000 a year, and today that's way below the poverty level. In 1971 you could buy a decent house for $30,000, in fact a very nice house, and now that's, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 for the exact same house. That in 1971 gold was $30-some-odd an ounce, now it's $1,600. Pick your commodity. Gasoline in 71 was 30 cents a gallon. Now it's almost $4. Are there commodities that have not gone up in value that would show that what we're looking at is commodity inflation rather than dollar depreciation or devaluation? Or is dollar devaluation just a natural thing that would have happened with or without our going from a gold standard to a fiat currency?
Well, the dollar has gone up in value and down in value over time against a range of different currencies. One week it's up, one year it's down, another month it's back up, another week it's down. So the dollar fluctuates against world currencies. And a whole range of goods and services have become much cheaper. Quality has improved. A number of things that we could look at aside from just the price of gold. But look, a lot of things have happened since 1971 that have led to declining standards of living for Americans. You know, since 1973, the real wages of the average American worker in this country have been stagnant, and more recently have been declining. And so, you know, you've got the demise of unions, and you've got the fact that corporate profits have been increasing, productivity has gone up over time, and real wages have stagnated. And so Americans have turned more and more to debt to finance their standard of living over time. And so there's just a whole range of things that have taken place, the financialization of the economy and so forth, that contribute to the decline in worker standards of living over time.
So we should be looking at standard of living rather than what a dollar will buy. I'm I'm on your side. I'm still not hearing an argument why the dollar is not depreciating, or why, if it is, it has nothing to do with gold standard or not gold standard.
Well, depreciating in terms of what? Depreciating against a basket of goods. So inflation is extraordinarily modest right now. The Fed can't even hit its very modest 2.5% inflation target. And so, you know, I don't see the devaluation of the U.S. dollar that so many people sort of wring their hands about. I mean, we've actually had for now a very long period of time, going all the way back to the Clinton era, where we had rising productivity, we had declining unemployment rates, we had what on the surface appeared to be a really healthy economy, and we had inflation that was extraordinarily modest even back then.
We have to take a very quick break, just a few seconds. We'll be back. Dr. Stephanie Kelton is with us, an economist and the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, editor-in-chief of the blog New Economic Perspectives, neweconomicperspectives.org, Modern Monetary Theory. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, our blog, neweconomicperspectives.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Stephanie Kelton is with us, an economist and chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, editor-in-chief of the New Economic Perspectives blog, neweconomicperspectives.org. Dr. Kelton, you were, in summary, saying the U.S. government is the issuer of our currency, and therefore we don't have to worry about borrowing from the Chinese, as it were. We can, you know, that the U.S. government can buy anything that's denominated in dollars because we have we the government have all the dollars. We create the dollars. And that really what constrains us is not the number of dollars we have, but the number of resources that we have. Am I restating that well?
Beautifully.
Okay. So that being the case, how do we make economic decisions in ways that don't have unintended consequences, that don't devalue the dollar, don't produce, create inflation or deflation for that matter, that don't, you know, screw up markets, don't bring about depressions? What should we be doing?
Well, okay, this is an excellent question. So, and it puts the focus where it belongs, which is back on the real economy. So what should we be doing? If we've got, the way we do today, about 22 million Americans who want full-time work and can't find it, we've got all of this slack in the economy. We've got factories that aren't operating anywhere near capacity. So there's lots of room for factories to ramp up production to meet rising demand for goods and services without creating bottlenecks and inflationary pressures. And so when economists talk about inflation, most of the time what you hear is people who are concerned about, you know, creating too much money chasing too few goods. So it's this, you know, there's more demand than there is the capacity in the economy to produce and satisfy that demand. Now, if that happens, you're going to get inflationary pressure. Well, what I'm suggesting is that we're nowhere near having that situation in the U.S. today, that we've got all kinds of room to run, both because we have 22 million Americans who want full-time work and can't find it, and because we have lots of capacity in the economy. We have lots of resources available that can be mobilized and used to produce the things that we need. And then the discussion becomes, well, what are those things? What do we as a society need? And that's a political question. That's a question for voters working through their elected officials to say, you know, whether it's we don't like the fact that our levees are breaking, that our bridges are falling down, that our water treatment facilities are in disrepair, that our airports and our schools and so forth. So if it's infrastructure, you can point to the National Infrastructure Report Card and you can say, you know, the civil engineers have told us what needs to be done. And the number is astounding. It's $2.2 trillion. That the civil engineers say we should be spending on our national infrastructure in order to bring it up to snuff, that it is in such bad disrepair. Now, this is not something that the private sector is going to do, right? This is a job for the public sector. So I'm just giving this by way of example. This is something where we can see lots of people who want to contribute. We can see useful work that needs to be done. And then we can ask the question, well, are the resources available to do that work? Can we put the workers together? Is there enough concrete, steel, copper, all of those things that we need in order to do this without creating inflationary pressure. How fast can we go? Where do we need to go more slowly? In every area in the economy, this should be the question. It's about whether we can put the resources to work, whether it will serve the public purpose, and whether we can do it without creating inflation, without competing with the private sector for those resources.
Now, the libertarians would suggest that if the roads are in sufficiently bad disrepair, if the bridges are seriously falling apart, that, you know, the Koch brothers are going to come along and see this as an opportunity for investment, and they'll build private roads with toll bridges on either end, and you'll have a private sector solution to all this stuff.
Well, in fact, the Koch brothers would like to come in and take over a fair bit of the national infrastructure, and the way that they can actually accomplish that is by allowing the state budgets to become so strained that you actually create a fiscal crisis at the state and local level, and you start getting states to sell off resources like power plants and toll roads and so forth.
It's happening right now.
It's happening right now.
Is that intrinsically or necessarily a bad thing?
Well, I don't know that in every case it is. There are certainly resources that are better are better for national security reasons and so forth. I think if they're in the public domain, but the main point is, I guess, that it doesn't have to happen. That state and local governments, well, they face the same kinds of constraints that you and I do, or that a private business does, because they don't issue the currency. And so when your income falls, my income were to fall in half overnight, and all of a sudden I'm left with half the disposable income, I'm going to be forced to tighten my belt and spend a whole lot less. And the same goes for a private business when its sales drop off, or from a state government or a local government when their tax receipts fall off, for example, because the economy goes into the tank. And this is what happened after the financial crisis and the ensuing economic meltdown in the states. But the federal government, because it's different, because it can spend and, in fact, must spend countercyclically, that the federal government has the capacity to do what none of the rest of us can do, which is to spend even as its income, so-called, is going down. So federal governments could step in, and they should step in, and they should have done this long ago and provided the backstop for these still struggling state and local governments so that they weren't forced to get into the situation where they're selling off assets to people like the Koch brothers.
Mm-hmm. So we have just a little less than a minute before the break here. How do we do that without creating inflation? How do you know when inflation is a danger?
Well, you know, inflation can arise for lots of different reasons. It doesn't just come, and it doesn't even mainly just come from the demand side of the economy, from people with too much money trying to buy too many goods and services that are produced in the economy. In fact, what we have chronically is a situation where there isn't enough total demand in the economy to buy all the goods and services that our businesses want to produce. So we look most of the time to the supply side of the economy. We can find oil price shocks and other things driving inflation. And there are ways to figure out when that's coming, and maybe some different things you can do in terms of policy to try to fight that inflation before it becomes a problem.
We have to take a 6-minute break for the news. You're with us for another 15 minutes? Great. Dr. Stephanie Kelton is here. We'll be right back. New Economic Perspectives.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once again, her blog is neweconomicperspectives.org. Check it out. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Stephanie Kelton with us, professor of economics, chair of the Department of Economics, in fact, at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, editor-in-chief of the New Economic Perspectives blog, neweconomicperspectives.org. Dr. Kelton, welcome back.
Thank you.
And thank you for staying with us for another few minutes here. I'm curious, you have this graphic, and in fact, Jim has it as a graphic. We're going to take a full screen right now so people who are watching TV can see it. People who are listening on radio, let me just describe it. Basically, what it shows is that as we generate government deficits, the red below the line, that's reflected by private sector surpluses, blue above the line, above the 0% line, and that there's some green in there, the foreign sector, which is our balance of surplus payments or deficits, the money that the extra that is either coming in or going out as a consequence of our trade deficit and other ways that our country makes money or loses money internationally. And that these three sectors are in balance, and it looks like whenever our government manages to balance its budget, that the private sector surplus collapses and we have a recession. This seems counterintuitive. Can you explain this?
Well, okay, yes. And I love this graphic, and I'm so glad that you're able to put it up for the folks who are able to take a look at this watching your program, because this really is a game changer in so many respects. When people begin to see things in this alternative way, because we've been so trained to think of the government's deficit as just a purely negative thing. And, you know, if we could eliminate it, well, by God, we ought to eliminate the deficit and balance the budget and so forth. And what we fail to, I think, recognize so often is that the government's deficit has to be considered in context. So when the government deficit spends, let's say the government spends 100, but they only collect back 90 in taxes. We label that a deficit. And the word itself sounds like some, you know, it's got a negative connotation. It sounds like something you want to avoid. But remember that when the government spends 100 into the economy and only takes 90 back out of the economy, that the extra 10 goes somewhere. And where it goes is into the non-government part of the economy. So either into the domestic private sector, you and I, the businesses, right, households and businesses in the U.S., or some of it could go abroad. It's possible that the U.S. contracts with a foreign producer of, let's say, aircraft carriers, and they get a government contract. Well, then it would go into the foreign sector. But the big point is, from this graphic, I think you see a couple of things going on here. One is, you can tell it's a perfect mirror image, which means the world is a closed system. Every payment out of one sector goes into some other sector in the economy. And what the other thing that you see is that almost all of the time, the government is in the negative. That's the red that you see below the zero line there. So the government is almost always spending more than it takes in, which allows other sectors to take in more than they spend. And the simple way of saying that in everyday language is that it allows somebody else to save. And the people that we want to be able to save money is, you know, folks like you and me and our private businesses, to be able to take in more money than we spend. And in fact, it's the government's ability and willingness to run those deficits that allows the private sector to achieve those surpluses. And you can see what happens when the private sector isn't allowed to run those surpluses or chooses on its own, let's say during the Clinton years. What happened during the Clinton years? You had a dot-com bubble. You had an emerging housing bubble. You had American consumers feeling like suddenly they became very wealthy because their stock portfolios were gaining in terms of value. Their home prices were beginning to go up. And so people start using their homes as ATM machines, and they start saying, well, I can afford to take on some more debt because look how wealthy I am on paper. And so for the first time, really, as your viewers can see here, the private sector started spending more than it takes in, running the deficits. Mm-hmm. And for period after period after period, the private sector continued to, we say, dissave, to spend more than its income. And at the same time the private sector was doing that, it's paying more to the government than the government is putting back in. And so we built those surpluses. You know, the Democrats love to point to the Clinton years, and they love to say we were the party of fiscal responsibility. We balanced the budget. We had budget surpluses, as if those were necessarily a good thing. And in fact, they weren't a good thing. They set the stage for the economic downturn. We had a recession. And then we had, of course, the mother of all financial collapses since the Great Depression in 2007. So the private sector really needs to live in surplus territory. It can periodically go down and run a deficit. But over the long haul, the private sector can't spend more than it takes in. Private sector needs to be in surplus. The government, by its willingness and its ability to spend more than it collects in taxes provides that cushion for the private sector to save.
So what is the role in all of this of international trade, of trade? Yeah, we ran trade surpluses for literally centuries, and China and Japan and South Korea and Germany are all running very large trade surpluses right now, and it seems to be cushioning them from the consequences of any sort of public sector debt, or for that matter, private sector debt. Would it not be to our advantage that this foreign sector, the green I'm seeing, is almost all above the line, and yet I thought our foreign sector balance of trade was negative. Is this a negative? Are we looking at double entry bookkeeping where negatives become apparent positives, or am I missing something other than the trade deficit? And would it not be to our advantage to have a trade surplus, and would that not allow us to reduce the government, quote, debt, end quote, and maybe diffuse some of the Rand Paul hysteria?
Yeah. Well, you're right. In terms of the current account, or we can just call it a trade surplus for shorthand, plays a very similar role to the government's deficit. So in countries like Germany, where they're able to run trade surpluses, it allows their government to run smaller budget deficits. In fact, there's an economist by the name of Nicholas Kaldor who nearly 100 years ago said that a trade surplus is like an artificial government deficit, and vice versa, that the government's deficit is like an artificial trade surplus. And so in both cases, if the government is spending more money into the economy than it's taking out by running a deficit, it has the same sort of impact on the private sector as when the rest of the world buys more from us than we buy from them. So
Ross Perot is right. We should have a trade surplus.
Well, I didn't say that though, right? Okay. I'm saying in a country like the United States, where you can run these trade deficits, which allow more dollars to go out of the country than are coming back in. Okay, that's true. But in the U.S., you can offset that with a government deficit that allows you to put more money back in than you're taking out and dampen the effects of that trade deficit. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can actually use your fiscal policy to engineer full employment domestically. We could do this. We could have trade deficits where the rest of the world is producing things more cheaply than we can produce them here. There are some things we can't produce here. And so we get goods and services produced in other parts of the world. And if we don't get our economic policy right here at home, then yes, that tends to increase the level of unemployment and economic distress and so forth. But what would happen if we actually understood the way the monetary system works? We understood that all of these barriers that we think are there aren't really there. We took advantage of our fiscal space. We got our policy right. We got full employment here domestically so that we could consume all of the things that it's possible for us to produce here at home, plus anything the rest of the world wants to produce and sell to us. Wouldn't that be the best of all possible worlds?
It seems like it, yeah. So it's just a matter of saying, of having a government policy, of basically the government being the employer of last resort. Would that be a reasonable way to say it?
Okay, so that's one program that many, many people working in this tradition of this school of thought that, you know, is often referred to as modern money theory. One of the things that we've talked about is how to get the economy to operate in a more stable way. So stability in terms of the financial side and also inflation. And so what we have done is over a period of 20 years or so come to the conclusion that you raised this, so I'm going to get into this.
We have just 1 minute left.
An employer of last resort, a program where the government guarantees full employment by offering to hire directly anybody who's ready, willing, and able to work and not able to find work in the private sector. And so that creates a buffer stock of employed people that can then flow into and out of the private sector as the economy naturally cycles, and that would actually help to provide price stability. It would be an inflation control mechanism. And so you would have full employment. you would have price stability, and you could have all of this in an open economy world in which the dollar is still the reserve currency of the world, and you're able to run trade deficits as well.
Remarkable. It's Dr. Stephanie Kelton, economist and chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, editor-in-chief of neweconomicperspectives.org blog. Dr. Kelton, I know you have to go. Thank you so much for being with us these 45 minutes. It's much appreciated, and I look forward to future conversations with you. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
NewEconomicPerspectives.org is Dr. Kelton's blog. One last time. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. And the Talk Radio News Service is brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and the effort to free Don Siegelman, free-don.com. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, my goodness. Well, we'll start with the sequester.
Okay.
The autumn. It sounds like something out of Slytherin, out of Harry Potter, really.
Indeed, it does.
It does. And it's about as nice as that, too. But we'll start with that. We got other things, but I want to give a nod to it. I'm sure you've been talking about
it. I have a very quick question about this, Victoria. The Republicans are now blaming the president for it, so apparently they don't like it. And the president is saying, you know, on behalf of the Democrats, it's a bad thing. Yeah. Why don't they just get together and undo it? I mean, it's simply a law passed by Congress. It could be reversed.
Yes, but because getting together and undoing it, and in fact, there are going to be bills introduced in the Senate tomorrow to do that sort of thing.
I see.
The reason they can't get together to undo it is because the Republicans want to get together to undo it by introducing alternative cuts. And the Democrats want to get together to undo it by introducing a mixture of cuts and revenue increases.
Why not just go back to where we were and just, you know, hey, okay, we're going to add in a little bit more to our deficit, but, you know, we'll work through that. We'll survive.
Nope.
They're not going to do that.
Nope.
No. Okay.
Not going to happen.
All right. So, as you were saying.
Lurch forward.
Yes.
Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary, came out to the briefing room today at the White House and warned that, as Ray LaHood warned on Friday, that the sequester would affect border security. She said her agency would be forced to furlough about 5,000 border control agents, and that could potentially compromise national security. She said disaster relief funding would be reduced by $1 billion, meaning relief for victims of natural disasters like Hurricane Sandy and tornadoes in Joplin, Missouri, and Tuscaloosa, Alabama, could be cut. She also talked about how the sequester would disrupt the Department of Homeland Security's ability to conduct customs inspections at ports, leading to increased waiting times for travelers and cargo shipments. She was asked whether the threats could make the country more susceptible to acts of terrorism. She said, it's always a threat. We do what we can to minimize the risk, but the sequester makes it awfully, awfully tough. She also made the point that more illegal immigrants were likely to come over the border. And, of course, she said, reducing the number of border control agents does affect our ability to keep out illegal immigrants out of the country. And as you know, in the discussion over forging some kind of immigration proposal that would be pretty comprehensive, making the border secure is a piece of it, really preparatory to any kind of deal. So that would rather set that back.
Indeed. So we're back to the, you know, neither side wants to just go back to where we were, status quo. Both sides are saying we got to do it our way.
Right. Your idea is a novel one, Tom.
Yes. Okay. So what else is up?
Not going anywhere. The Deepwater Horizon trial opened in New Orleans today. The Department of Justice, a number of southern states versus BP.
Mm-hmm.
11 sets of lawyers. They had to open two or three spillover rooms.
Wow.
They've got about 400 minutes of opening arguments. It was unbelievable. So Michael Underhill, who's the Justice Department lawyer, opened the arguments, and he said BP knew it was drilling a well from hell. He said that BP, the man in charge of BP's ill-fated Deepwater Horizon rig, warned his boss that staff were operating in chaos, paranoia, and insanity just days before the blowout. He said that the tragedy is that it was caused by failures that didn't even amount to pocket change. He said the problem was they were trying to save money. BP calculated it needed $7 billion to pay shareholders their dividend, so they put immense pressure on staff to save money and drill faster in order to reach the target. He cited in evidence a number of things, but an email that's coming into evidence from BP's well team leader John Guy to David Sims, a drilling and completions operations manager, that it says... Guy told Sims that BP's well site leaders were at wit's end. There was a huge level of paranoia that was riding chaos. The well was proving impossible. They were trying to make sense of all the insanity. The operation is not going to succeed if we continue in this manner, he warned. Sims responded that he had to go to dance practice in a few minutes. I'll be back soon and we can talk. I'm dancing to the Village People.
Dance practice? Really?
That's correct.
Okay. Oh.
Yes. You can't make this stuff up.
And then 11 men died.
That's correct.
Yeah. Is anybody going to go to jail for this?
No, I don't think this is this is about money.
Yeah. Okay.
Nobody's going to jail.
Yeah.
Meantime, on the other side of the pond, the top British cardinal resigns today after accusations of inappropriate acts.
Now, this is the Episcopalian cardinal?
No, this is the Catholic cardinal.
Oh, okay.
Cardinal Keith O'Brien. Now, this story came out yesterday that he has been accused of inappropriate acts dating back to the 1980s by three current priests and one ex-priest. Hmm. He says he submitted his resignation months ago. The Vatican said Pope Benedict accepted it on February the 18th. However, the timing of the announcement, one day after the news reports of the alleged abuse appeared in Britain, is suggesting the Vatican encouraged him to stay away from the conclave, which he was all set to go and vote in.
Right.
He will not vote in the conclave. This has never happened before.
Hmm.
He will retire. Yeah. And, of course, there is quite a lot of pressure being put on Cardinal Roger Mahoney of Los Angeles not to attend the conclave because of his role in moving priests around accused of abuse to other parishes.
Right. Remarkable. Remarkable. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.com. Excuse me. Yeah, goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.com. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. We will be back with Joshua Holland, who's going to tell us about the new Welfare Queen line.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the right wing has come up with a new bogus theory about poverty. The basically the Heritage Foundation, all the talking points that are being distributed to the Republicans, and you'll find in the right wing blogs and whatnot, this, that, and the other thing here and there and everywhere else, are that broken families, single parents are leading to poverty, which is, and of course, lazy people. And then poverty produces bad outcomes, you know, like gang violence and that sort of thing. And it turns out that it's really the other way around, that poverty is what breaks up families. And so the question is, what do you do about poverty? And Franklin Roosevelt had a really good answer to that. He said the very best welfare program is a job, which gets us back to what Stephanie Kelton was talking about. Make the government the employer of last resort. If we've got 20% unused productive capacity in our economy right now, if up to 20% of our workforce could be far more productive, if we've got empty factories all over this country, if we've got rolling stock, we've got railroad stock that could be turned into high-speed rail, we've got highways that could be filled with electric cars, and we've got gas stations. You just go on and on. We have an internet infrastructure that is old and aging and falling apart. Let's do something about it. We're the richest nation on earth. We've got all these natural resources. Now, I get it. We've privatized a lot of them. And the Koch brothers of the world are trying to get us to privatize even more of them. A brand new thing up from Media Matters about how this organization that has come up with $400 million for a whole bunch of right-wing groups is now paying to put John Stossel's face in your schools with libertarian talking points. They've got these new educational programs we're going to teach you all about. And these are, you know, these are moments where you look at all the hundreds of millions of dollars that the right wing has to spend to make sure that the right wing, that a.k.a. the billionaires, will have more hundreds of millions of dollars. These are really investments. Used to be we invested in our country. Now the right wing is buying our country. And eventually they're going to say, okay, guys, that's it. And here's the problem. Back when we used to have trade policies that basically said, if you're an American corporation, you do business in the United States. And if you're going to make things to sell to people in this country, you're going to make them in this country. There used to be this sense of nationalism. And I don't mean nationalism in the Nazi sense. I mean nationalism in the, hey, this is my country sense. And now increasingly what we have is transnationalism. We have corporations and billionaires who don't care what country it is. And they don't care if the United States goes down in flames. You know, really what it's all about for them is, I want another $1 billion. Well, $2 billion? Make it five. Five, make it ten. You can't live on $10 million a month anymore. You know, it's that kind of thing. And so why don't, you know, particularly acknowledging that we no longer live in a gold standard world, why don't we simply say, let's take the 7.5% of people officially, or as Bernie Sanders would point out, the 14, 15, 16, 17% of people really who would like to have a full-time job and don't, and put those people to work. Using U.S. dollars created by the U.S. government, by the U.S. Treasury, an ideal situation. And put those people to work and move them out of the category of taking government funds in the form of welfare and unemployment benefits and things like that, and move them into the category of, even though their paycheck is coming from the government, move them into the category of paying taxes, of being taxpayers, and being consumers rather than just basically just getting by. And as they become consumers, that demand drives the economy. As that demand drives the economy, more and more private companies will step up. Entrepreneurs will step in to fill the demand. As demand grows, then, you know, over time, what we'll see is that less and less does the government need to be the employer of last resort, because now there's, you know, the economy is functioning better and the private sector grows and steps in and picks up the slack. I mean, this is people who say, oh, well, government spending doesn't solve anything, are the same people who will tell you, oh, World War II got us out of the Great Depression. Well, if World War II wasn't a massive government spending program financed by debt, what was? Oh, yeah, I guess it was. And what did it do? Oh, it got us out of the Great Depression. How did it do it? It put everybody to work. Oh, really? And then what did we do after that? We borrowed a bunch of money and we gave people money to buy houses. We sent them to college. And what was the consequence of that? 30 years of prosperity, the biggest middle class the world has ever seen. Please tell me how this is crazy. David in Corona, California, you think you know how this is wrong. Tell me.
No, I agree with a lot of what you said, Tom. You're absolutely right, because if the United States goes down for the transnationalists, it's nothing more than debt restructuring for them.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
They move out of dollars into Swiss francs.
Right.
They move
right.
out of New York and into Zurich.
Right, or into China and continue the growth. Then you're overburdened, you overextend their debt, and then you'll crash them and you move on to Brazil.
That's right.
That's how it really works. But, Tom, the reason why I called, because the economist that you had on, there was one thing that I thought that was extremely dangerous, what she said, that can be construed by the listening audience that can get them in a lot of trouble. And that was when she said that the dollar is not dying or is not collapsing. The dollar is being smothered right now by debt and confidence.
How so?
There is.
Why is it that inflation is at historic lows right now if the dollar is being smothered?
But the dollar is because of the debt is unserviceable, Tom. And most
That's
money,
not true.
Most of the U.S. dollars is held outside of this country.
That's not true either. About $2 trillion of the U.S. deficit is held outside the United States. Most of it, you know, $3 trillion of it is held by the U.S. government itself. It's the government owing itself money. $2.7 trillion of that is the Social Security Trust Fund. There's another trillion dollars in federal pensions and state pensions that are held in Treasury bills. I mean, this is George Bush, when he came into office in 2000, in 2001, when he gave his State of the Union address, his very first, he'd been in office for like a month. He came out and he made this speech. He said, "We're going to pay off all the debt that can be paid off," and this was just with this little tiny 3% tax increase that Bill Clinton had, the Clinton surplus. This is how rich this country is. If you simply reduce unemployment by 2 or 3 or 4 points, suddenly you've got so much surplus being generated that George W. Bush can say this:
"Our national debt. I listened, and I agree. We owe it to our children and grandchildren to act now. And I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years. At the end of those 10 years, we'll have paid down all the debt that is available to retire. That is more debt repaid more quickly than has ever been repaid by any nation at any time in history."
And then, of course, somebody sat George down and said, "No, you don't want to do that, because if you replay all that debt, then you're taking away the private savings of the private sector." David?
Okay, but as for the everyday person, our labor is being devalued by the dollar being devalued.
But the dollar's not being devalued, David.
It definitely is.
That's called inflation, and inflation ain't happening. In fact, the biggest problem we have, frankly, I think right now, is deflation. That it's harder and harder to get dollars. But David, we're gonna have to live to debate this another day, because the music is telling me we're out of time. Thank you for calling. Do call back. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. How do we save this economy? Employer of last resort?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's not only a brilliant idea, the government as employer of last resort, it actually worked in the 1930s and 1940s, and it was proposed by Franklin Roosevelt in his new Bill of Rights. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was listening to the professor, what's her name?
Stephanie Kelton, K-E-L-T-O-N.
Yeah, Kelton. And I was fascinated about the part you were talking about, where government deficits correspond with private sector surpluses.
Right.
So what, and she said it's
plus or minus the trade deficit.
Image. Yeah. And this is virtually a mirror image.
Yes.
Which suggests to me that the economy is essentially a zero-sum game.
Yes, the economy of our country. When you take these three pieces, the government deficit or surplus, the private sector deficit or surplus, and then the money going in and out of the in and out of our country deficit or surplus, which is mostly trade, although there's a few other pieces to it. Yes,
right, and so
it's a closed loop.
Other than economic growth, there's no other way for that to be true. But for that to be true, that it's a zero sum game. Now, when you look at economic growth on a $15 trillion GDP, 5% would be a stellar economic growth. Do you agree?
5% would be astonishing. We had 3% right. average growth per decade in the decades of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and it was the largest and most sustained growth we've ever had in the history of this country, 3%.
Well, let me use 5% for sake of argument. 5% on a $15 trillion economy is $750 billion. Now, when you if you divide that by every single person in the country, 300 million, that's only $2,500 per year per person. And given a that the average income is about $26,000, this reflects only about a 10% increase in wealth. But nobody is seeing that at that level.
Right. Although you would have to pretty much double, maybe triple that number, because the number of taxpayers, the number of people who are actually working, is a little over 100 million. You're including six-year-olds in that 300.
Yeah, but that even makes my argument even stronger, that the people at the $25,000 level are certainly not seeing a 30% increase in their wealth.
That's correct. And the reason why is because the billionaires are seeing a 400% increase.
Exactly, because the top percentages are taking all the growth.
Right,
and that's why the lower end of the economy, the people in the lower end of the economy, are getting worse and worse. Because even when the economy grows, the fat cats are eating it all up.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean that's simple math. That's easy to follow. That's the easiest math.
One of the best examples of this is that we just got the numbers for the 2010-2011 fiscal year, and it turns out that 114% of increased income went to the top 1%. 114%. What that means is the other 99% actually saw a decline in their income. Because it's got to net out to zero, to 100%. 100% of income, which would be a baseline, a zero line. So,
can I ask you a question, Tom?
Sure.
Europe has a slightly larger GDP, the European Union, about $16 trillion GDP. Now, isn't the European Union a smaller, if it were all united, which it is, smaller and has fewer people than the United States, and they're primarily social republics. So how do they have a bigger GDP with fewer people and a smaller
pretty
mass?
Pretty sure they have more people. I thought the population of Europe in aggregate was somewhere between 600 and 800 million people.
That much bigger.
I could be wrong. I haven't added. I mean, you just. Okay, Germany is what, 54 million? France is around 50 million. Italy's probably around 35 million. I mean, Spain is around 25 or 30 million.
And you're starting to run into smaller and smaller countries, see?
Yeah, I am. I am. And I'm starting to run out fast here, so it may well be. I honestly.
They're only slightly larger.
Okay, Shano just Googled it, 500 million people in the European Union.
So they're only slight. They're well, okay.
So they're almost twice as big as we are in terms of population.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, that was just a thought.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Sorry, I didn't know the actual number off the top of my head there. Thank goodness for Shano and the DuckDuckGo machine or Google machine or whatever it is. Manuel in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hey, Manuel.
Hi, Tom.
You want to talk about trade policy?
Before I ask my question, I do agree in principle with President Roosevelt's bill for employment and all that.
Mm-hmm.
My only caveat is we need to shut down free trade.
Yeah, I agree. And so did Roosevelt, by the way. Roosevelt maintained a roughly 30% tariff on all goods imported into the United States throughout his presidency. And it seemed to work just fine. It kept American jobs here in the United States.
Sorry to interrupt. The question that I was originally calling in, that the economist that was just on, the closing statement appeared to indicate that we can continue with free trade and by use of monetary policy have 100% employment of those who are not hired by the private sector. And my question is, who gains and all the profits from that?
Well, I think that I can't speak for Stephanie Kelton on that. My personal opinion of that is that it's not a good thing for a country to have a trade deficit. That, her point is, there's lots of stuff that we don't make here in the United States. And yes, the French have have cornered the market on French wines, although we make pretty good wines in California. Or there are countries that have, maybe South Africa does diamonds and we don't do diamonds or rubies out of Thailand or whatever. But in terms of manufacturing, I think that pretty much anything can be made here as can be made elsewhere in the world.
I agree with you on that.
But in saying that, I'm not calling for the end of trade. We've always been a nation that has engaged in trade. What I'm suggesting is that we should be doing the same thing that China and Germany and Japan and South Korea are doing, and that is engage in trade in a way that pretty much guarantees that we keep our jobs and that we generate a trade surplus. And people will say, well, that's mercantilism. And I'd say, yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. And it built this country. And they'll say, well, but there's going to be losers in the world if we're the winner in the world. And I'd say, yeah. So let's, you know, worst case scenario, let's try for a trade surplus and deficit of zero. And you can have millions and millions of dollars of stuff that we export, millions and millions of dollars of stuff that we import. But let's try to balance it. And if you did that, then you could decrease our national debt without impacting the private sector. Manuel, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So bottom net, net, bottom line, I am opposed to so-called global free trade, just speaking for myself. The bad and the very, very teleophobically ugly. The good. The campaign to stop killer robots. Activists around the world fear what could be a Skynet future if the world's militaries continue to embrace fully autonomous weaponized machinery. The Guardian is reporting that activists plan to unveil this new campaign against killer robots in April at the British House of Commons, pointing out the surge in the use of unmanned drones. In a recent report by Human Rights Watch that warns about machines under development, the campaign to stop killer robots insists this isn't science fiction and that already in America, more pilots are being trained on drones than actual aircraft. Keep an eye on this movement. It could be very important in the future, especially if the drones ever become self-aware. The bad. Montana State Representative Steve Levin. It wasn't just a matter of time until some lunatic Republican stretched corporate personhood to its logical ends, and Steve Levin did just that, introducing a bill in the Montana State House to give corporations a right to vote. Under the bill, a firm, partnership, company, or corporation holding property would have a right to vote just as a citizen votes. So just to be clear, while we're taking away the rights of actual people to vote with new voter suppression ID laws, one Republican wants to expand voting rights to artificial people, to corporations that don't have a brain or a body. We need to end this insanity before corporations are given Second Amendment rights and begin placing cannons on top of their corporate headquarters. Go to movetoamend.org. And the very, very ugly, the Joint Strike Fighter Caucus. Last week we learned that the entire fleet of F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, was grounded after problems were discovered with the engine. So far, the F-35 project is the most expensive in the history of the military, costing you and me, the taxpayers, roughly $400 billion and is roughly 6 years behind schedule. And given the way wars are fought nowadays, it's unlikely the F-35 will even play a critical role in our armed services. But money keeps getting poured back into this Pentagon black hole because the Joint Strike Fighter Caucus in Congress is more committed to funneling fortunes to their war profiteer buddies than to public education, health care, or infrastructure. Plain and simple, if you think we have a debt crisis and yet you want to keep funding military programs we don't need instead of health care programs that we do need, then you're not a deficit hawk. You're just very, very ugly. Or at least your policies are. Not sure I'd make that into an ad hominem, but... Oh, my... So what these conservatives have done, and in fact it's Daniel Halper at the Weekly Standard. That's interesting. I've debated Daniel before. I'm going to have to get him on and talk about this. He has been cited by hundreds of conservative blogs and Fox News and whatnot. And Halper basically says that welfare spending per day per household in poverty is $168 a day, which is higher than the $137 median income per day. In other words, people on welfare are making more than most working people. And the way that they get to these numbers is by adding up basically every government program that's out there as if somebody could get them all. Now, many of them mutually cancel each other. You know, if you're getting this, you're not eligible for that. If you're getting this, then you're, you know, or you can't get both this and that. And the fact of the matter is that people in poverty are actually in poverty. But that doesn't stop the right from using these funny numbers. And I think this is just astounding is the word that Joshua Holland uses. And I think it's a good one, how an astounding new right-wing lie about the economy was born. Genuinely astounding. David, in Belen, New Mexico, you want to talk about infrastructure spending.
Right. Your earlier guest, I agreed with her about the $2 trillion, but when you're spending it at Walmart, you got a hole in your ship because your manufacturing is offshore.
Right. The hole in your shoe being the, you know, the money flowing out going to China is what you're talking about.
Well, your ship, actually.
Your,
but yes, yes.
Oh, your ship, S-H-I-P. Right. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Thank
yes,
you. trying to make sure I don't have to push the dump button here.
Okay. So, therefore, your multiplier effect is not as effective as
right.
it should be.
Although it's still over one. And as long as it's over one, there's some value to it. But I agree with you. And that's one of the reasons why I think that, you know, so-called global free trade policies are not a good idea. Although, you know, I'm not the economist. Stephanie Kelton is, and she's of the opinion that if we were to go to full employment, that there would be plenty of demand for things made in the United States. And I believe that what she's saying, and I, you know, I may well be wrong on this. I shouldn't. In fact, I'm not going to speak on her behalf. What I have heard people who represent themselves as representing modern money theory suggest is something to the effect of, if we go to full employment, there will be enough demand inside the United States that the whole issue of whether or not we had a trade deficit will become, you know, less and less relevant, more and more irrelevant. And
I have,
I'm skeptical of that.
I have one other question.
Yeah.
You know, Cisco Systems is predominantly the infrastructure of the internet, but that was developed, I mean, taken from a transistor to ARPANET. The U.S. Army, I believe, was running ARPANET. That's an investment by the American people.
Yeah, it was DARPANET. It was the Defense Department. Yes, you're absolutely right. The internet was created by legislation that was initially authored by Al Gore. As he once pointed out, and the Republicans never let him forget.
But the thing is that government fueled the internet.
Yes.
And now our investment is offshore, and Cisco is predominantly made in China.
Mm.
And their factory in Russia is coming online, which has no multiplier effect here in the United States. Yet the American people funded this research.
Yeah, yes and no. You could argue that it has no multiplier effect because the money is going overseas and the goods are coming here to the extent that many of these products, like, you know, people like to talk about Apple products. A fair amount of what's in Apple products are actually made in the United States. It's not all made in China. And increasingly things are coming back to the United States. But, you know, frankly, when you look at the countries that are being successful in running mercantilist policies, that are successful in having trade surpluses, which can balance out and neutralize the effect of and diminish the need for trade budget deficits. When you look at those countries that do that, they do that by having either tariffs or the functional equivalent of tariffs in value-added taxes that can be reversed out upon export and doubled upon import. David, thank you for the call. Let me just explain that very, very quickly, because I think it's a really important point. You either say, okay, if it costs a dollar's worth of labor to make a pair of shoes in Connecticut and in the United States, and if you want to make those shoes in Mexico where it would be 50 cents worth of labor, or in Taiwan where it would be 30 cents worth of labor, then we're going to tax at the border when you bring those shoes into the United States. 50-cent tax coming from Mexico, a tariff with Mexico of 50 cents, and a tariff from Taiwan of 70 cents. In other words, at the end of the day, it's going to cost a dollar functionally for the labor in those shoes, regardless of where you make them. Now, when you have those kinds of tariff policies, as we had in the United States, literally, quite literally, from 1793, when Alexander Hamilton, you know, proposed them in 1791, 1793, the Washington administration, George Washington, Washington administration, and, you know, put them into place, and some by legislation, some by executive policy, et cetera. When you, from 1793 until they began disintegrating during the Nixon administration, it picked up a little speed during the Reagan administration, and it really fell apart during the Clinton administration. And now the average tariff on imported goods is in the neighborhood of 2%. We still have tariffs, and we still have tens of thousands of different tariff categories and items, but our average import tariff is 2%. Whereas from 1793 until the 1980s, our average import tariff was around 30%. So up until that time, up until our tariffs fell apart, you know, manufacturers just made intelligent decisions. They said, hey, you know, if it's going to cost a dollar's worth of labor to make the shoes in the United States, and if we make them in Mexico where labor is 50 cents, we have to pay a 50-cent import tax. And if we're going to make them in Taiwan where the labor is 30 cents, we're going to have to pay a 70-cent import tax. What the heck? Let's just make them in the United States. Why bother making them outside the United States? You got to pay shipping. It's hassle. You know, you got to fill out those forms and everything. We'll just keep our factories here. And so we kept our factories here from 1793 until the Reagan administration. Now, the way that the Europeans do this, the way Germany does this, the way Mexico does this, the way China does this, the way Taiwan does this, the way South Korea does it, is they say, oh, yeah, we all signed those free trade agreements along with the United States. So we have this thing called the value-added tax. So when you mine iron ore and you convert it into steel, that adds value to it. And so there's a small tax, a couple of pennies added on. And then when you take that steel and you turn it into rolled steel, you add a couple more pennies in tax. And that, you know, so each stage of production, which is done typically by different companies, each one of those stages of production, you add a tax. And so by the time that becomes a door on a car, by the time that becomes a car, there may be a total value added tax on everything in that car of, say, 15, 16, 17%, which is pretty much the world's average. So then you say, if we're going to export this, now that's the tax that people inside Germany have to pay. They're Germans. They all agree to pay that tax. But if you're going to export that car to the United States, then we can reverse out that 16, 17% tax and discount that car by 17%. That's the equivalent of an export subsidy. On the other hand, if you're going to make a car in the United States and ship it into Germany, there's no VAT tax on it. So we're going to charge you 17% when you import it. That's the equivalent of a tariff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that's why we have to do one of two things right away. And either one, go back to tariffs, or number two, join the rest of the world and get a VAT tax. Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dick in San Diego. Hey, Dick, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. You wanted to talk about our national debt?
Yeah, several callers ago, they were talking about the national debt as being allocated on a per capita basis and
right.
so on, or at least that's
right.
the way I would say that.
Right.
I think we need to look at this totally differently. It's very difficult on the Internet to find a net worth or a net value of the United States. And the numbers that I have seen go anywhere from several hundred trillion dollars to between one and 2 million trillion dollars. Okay. I don't even know what that number is called. It's
right.
you know, 1 to 2 times 10 to the 12th dollars. Okay.
Right. right.
And I would propose that instead of allocating the national debt on a per capita basis, that we allocate it on a basis that's proportional to the net worth of an individual or the net worth of a corporation.
In other words, the way that you would say, okay, the mortgage on your home has to be, you know, can't be more than, well, actually, typically they do it on payments. You know, your payments can't be more than a certain percentage of your monthly income, that sort of thing. But basically, you look at it that way.
Well, what I would think would be, since the net worth, let's just guess that the net worth of the United States is 1.7 times 10 to the 12 dollars, and the national debt is 1.7 times 10 to the 10th dollars,
okay?
So in that case, the net debt would be approximately 1% of the net worth of the country.
Right.
And I would think that we could put like a property tax on the country. I don't know whether it's legal in the Constitution or whether it's totally outside of what the Constitution would regulate, but put a property tax that might make everyone pay back 1% of their net worth, let's say over several years, like 5 years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that's interesting is I've looked at the numbers, and a person's whose net worth is on the order of $1 million, and that's someone that owns, you know, a decent piece of property and doesn't have a mortgage on it, and, you know, so on and so forth, they would be just about break even with on a per capita basis.
Mm-hmm.
But it would not be the staggering load on individuals with less net wealth.
Right.
And it would allow this staggering national debt to be basically paid off by the people who it helps the most, the very, very wealthy.
Right. This is my here's a variation on this, is our No Billionaires project, nobillionaires.com. And that is that we say, you know, it's fine to be worth $900 million. It's fine to have, you know, homes and yachts and $900 million. Fine to have $999,999,000. But when you hit $1 billion, every dollar after that, we're going to tax your wealth at the rate of 100%. So the most anybody can ever have is $1 billion. And, you know, how much do you need after all? And use the rest of that money to rebuild this country and to reestablish the middle class.
Well, my feeling is that this idea that we should pay off the national debt on a per capita basis is just an elaborate sham to sort of protect the very rich.
I agree. Because anytime you say per capita, you're saying basically per person cap, you know, per and when you're talking per person, you're talking about the 99%. Let's have, you know, the 99%. And that's why these guys advocate flat taxes. And that's why these guys have the, you know, all these crazy, and why they're pushing for a national sales tax rather than a national income tax. And God forbid we should talk about a wealth tax like I just talked about. So, I'm with you, Dick. Thought provoking stuff. Thank you for the call. Stephen, in Riverdale, Maryland. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, all right. How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I love your show, and I'll be very brief here. I have to disagree with you about people on welfare do make more money than working class people. And now let me preface that with we know recently that the Supreme Court declared that corporations were in fact people. So if you include the corporations that are on welfare, i.e. the oil cartels and the other industries, Facebook, the tax breaks that they give and the loopholes that are given to them, that is considered corporate welfare, and therefore those that are on welfare do make more than the working class.
A hell of a lot more. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, Stephen. Fascinating point. Well said. Thank you very much for that. Scott in Oak Island, North Carolina. 1 minute to the end of the show, Scott. It's yours.
I just wanted to say that I think the sequestration would be a good thing for us. We do need to cut our government spending.
Why?
Politicians.
Why?
They're out of control with their spending.
Come on, Canada spends about 50% of their total GDP is government spending. Ours is 22%. Tell me we're out of control.
It seems that way.
No, it's not that way. It's genuinely not that way. I think you could make a strong argument that our Pentagon spending is out of control. And
part of it.
You know, and there are places in our government where, you know, hey, let's have a new Chertoff porno x-ray machine for the airports kind of thing. You know, let's have more privatized prisons. We do have some spending that has these positive feedback loops. It's where you turn the thermostat up and it makes the house colder. And so, you know, or vice versa, you know, you turn the air conditioning down and it makes the house warmer.
Why do we look to other countries and say we wouldn't judge it by that way? Why not? You know, let us be free.
If you look at the average of the 34 OECD countries, the wealthiest nations in the world, if you take all of those countries together and average it out, excluding the United States, on average, government spending accounts for a little over 45% of GDP. Again, ours is 23%. We are not overspending in the United States. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest on the sequestration. Will Congress do the right thing for we the people? Plus, What's the real reason conservatives want the president to give up on green energy? We'll have a debate with Diana Furchot Roth of the Manhattan Institute. And the best of the rest of the news along with your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag your it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.